know what really makes us mad? Is wasting money on CDs with only one or two good songs.
Yeah. Tell them about punk!
What's up, posers? Welcome to Punk Lotto Pod. I'm your co-host, Justin Hensley.
And I am your other co-host, Dylan Hensley.
And today we are joined by Stefan Belthamir of the band The Big Easy. I hope I said that right. Who just recently put out their first full-length record, A Long Year, Forged Artifact Records. The record is fantastic. I've said it a couple times to him directly, but it's a truly excellent record, so I definitely recommend people check it out. The conversation's really good. What are we talking about today?
So today we are talking about the 1997 album Nothing Feels Good by The Promise Ring. So we are hitting a milestone emo record, 90s emo record, and kind of just 1997 in general. We spent a lot of time on a lot of other music.
Yeah. So at the beginning of the episode, you'll notice there's a slight strangeness going on with Dylan's vocal, Dylan's side of the conversation. Why don't you tell people why?
I bought a car, and I was driving. And it was a lot louder than I expected. So it was not an ideal recording situation. So we ended up breaking this episode in half. Mm-hmm. Of course, I don't think I said all that much.
Yeah, so the first part of the conversation is primarily like interviewee type general conversations with Stefan, and so it's like talking about The Big Easy and the new record and all that good stuff. So, yeah, Dylan didn't really chime in too much until the end of that, and then we just stopped and like picked up the next day and recorded then. So, don't worry about the audio quality on this one. Dylan doesn't talk for too long inside his car, so.
I muted for most of the time that I was in there, so
yeah.
If it sounds really rough at first, bear with it, because
yeah.
it cleans up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But otherwise, follow us on all forms of social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, at Punk Lotto Pod, you know, all the good stuff. So, yeah, hope you enjoy the show.
Take it outside.
Say
I had a few questions about the Big Easy first before we even talk about like 97 and the album. First of all, I want to say the new record is amazing.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's your first full length, right?
That is correct. Yeah.
Which is like awesome, because I was going back and looking at like your Bandcamp, and like the first things on there are around what, 2014? Does that sound about right?
Yeah. Yeah. I dropped like our first EP around 2014, which was kind of just like songs that I wrote before even like the Big Easy was even a thing, you know. And then like once I kind of like started the thing, the Big Easy, I recorded those songs and put that out. So that was the very like first like kind of thing we put together, but it was just like an EP. It was never like a full-length album, I would say.
Yeah. And then I found the, when it's like a 2016 version of Fun and Games that's on your right. new record as well.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
I was like, oh shit. Like these yeah. songs have been bouncing around for a while.
Yeah, yeah. That song, that's, I mean, when you know what they say, right? Like you have your whole life to write your first record. So yeah, that song is like, yeah, it came out. I had a version of that song in 2016. Yeah, totally. That's when I wrote it. I wrote it and I was like, all right, I'm just going to record this right now. So it sounds yeah. like, it definitely sounds like that too.
Well, it's got this sound to it that, I kind of got this vibe from the new record too. It's, I've been calling this sound like Heartland punk, or like I like to say Pettycore, like Tom Pettycore, but it's mm-hmm. not 100% in that vein. But
right,
like I get like the band Timeshares out of New York, they do it a little bit. Gaslight Anthem, of course, mm-hmm. Beach Slang, and I wondered too if that is even like a thing that's on your radar. Like I know you're from New Jersey, which is, you know, right. the Springsteen state. Does that mm-hmm. does he play an influence? Does Gaslight play an influence on your music, or is it just like just happenstance that you've come along?
Yeah, I would say it's probably more happenstance, to be honest. I don't listen to any of those bands. And not a knock at all. I mean, they're all, you know, great. They got a lot of fans and they're all great. It's just I just don't really like listen to them on a regular basis. I'd say the only thing I kind of listened to what you named was Beach Slang, and I haven't listened to them in a while. But it's funny. I mean, I definitely heard some of those comparisons in the past. But yeah, actually, I don't really draw. I haven't listened to them enough to say that I've actually like drawn any kind of like inspiration or anything from them. But I mean, it could just happen because we're like from the same area, and like, you know, so there could be some influence in that regard, I'd say.
I definitely get to, like, these are just my observations too. Like, I get a little bit of the, I want to say garage rock, but I mean more in like the Japandroids, like right. that type of mm-hmm. garage rock, like especially on like the filters you use on your vocals and right. effects like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was just curious, like, what are your like primary influences, if you even call it that?
Right, right.
Yeah, this point, I mean, like boiling it down that simply.
Life
but...
is the influence. Like cheap beers and life.
Yeah.
No, I mean, like, it was, I've always just really loved, like, vocal distortions, and, like, I always felt that, you know, I could use my vocals as an instrument as well. And I think that's kind of my my idea behind that. You know, it's just like, why not put the vocals through a guitar amp? Why not, like, have fun with it? I mean, like, it's just like any other instrument, and that's the way I viewed it. But I also really love lo-fi music, which, I mean, you can hear in the record. And I think that a big thing in lo-fi music is kind of, you know, muffled vocals or distorted vocals or vocals that are kind of like far back or roomy and stuff like that. And that was that, I think that's a big part of it as well. So what I tried to achieve with the records, I tried to find a middle ground between the two, like having something that you know, listeners can actually hear the vocals and the, you know, the words and the content lyrically, but also still has that like very roomy, live, fucked up, distorted sound to it that I wanted to achieve as well. I think we did a pretty good job at it. I'm sure some stuff like totally gets lost in there, but it's just kind of like what comes with, you know, the vibe. If you're gonna do all that to your vocals or like make them roomy and stuff, some of the stuff might get lost, and I've accepted that. But for the most part, I think it sounds like I'm very happy with the way it came out. So, yeah, I think that most of the influence really did come from, like, trying to have, like, that lo-fi sound to it.
It's funny. I sent the video for Fun and Games to my friend, and the first thing he commented was, like, I love the effect on the vocals. Like,
yes!
So it works. Yes! It totally works. So, like,
love to hear that. Love to hear that.
So is this a full-fledged band at this point, or is it still essentially, like, you do what you can and then just have some friends help out?
I would say it's more of a full-fledged band at this point. You know, I started this thing on my own, but at this point, like, you know, my band, you know, Steven, Pete, and who fills in on bass for most of the time is our friend Mateo. Yeah, we've been playing together for quite some time now, and they've had a huge part in the record recording process as well. So at this point, like, I think it's I present this as a full band. I don't think it's safe to say that I'm the only one doing, you know, everything anymore. I still do most of, like, a lot of the things here in regards to, like, the songwriting and, like, that process, but it does get filtered through the rest of the band. And I think, to me, in my personal opinion, I think that's kind of, like, how a lot of bands kind of operate these days.
It's true. We had Elise Okusami from Oceanator on earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, she has some people she plays with, but she writes most of the songs, and, like, everything is all, like, her writing. She recorded a lot of the instruments on that record, too. And then we had Hoagie from Sunny Falls on, too. And he's more like yours. Like, he has a regular, like, people he plays with, but it is still essentially, like, his songs, his, you know, arrangements. So
I just think that it's just harder to kind of, like, I had a rotating cast of musicians, you know, in the past. It's just harder to kind of make that shit happen. And, you know, once you give, you know, people a sense of ownership to what you're doing, you know, I think they deliver more, and it's just more fun to kind of, like, gel with people and, like, get a sound going. And having a rotating cast is cool, but for me, it's just so much easier to, like, you know, have, like, a band, you know, the Big Easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely makes sense. It probably helps too that you've got, like, established, like, I write the songs, like,
right? Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that kind of comes with, I was doing it a lot longer before they, you know, were.
Yeah,
right. So I mean, like, at that, if you look at it from that regard, like, they're joining something that I've already worked and made. So I mean, I think that in any regard, if you join in on something, you know, you can't really try to, like, you know, become, you can't take what someone else is.
Right,
you
know? Right. Yeah.
And when someone has, like, a vision for what they're doing, when someone has spent time on something, you don't necessarily want to come in and be like, well, I really think we should do this, unless they're asking for that, you know?
Exactly, you know? And
like, hey, I really want some feedback on this. Like, do we want to, you know, change the structure of the song, or, you know, whatever it might be?
Exactly. And I think that, like, that is what I think is important in, like, setting, like, the ground rules, I guess, when you start a band and whatnot. Like, for the most part, like, all the bands I've been in, it usually was, like, a main songwriter. And then we just, like, you know, in my past bands, like, I would play bass in other bands, and there'd be a main songwriter, and we would just, like, bring us the songs. It's like, okay, cool, and this is what I'll try to contribute to the songs. And then there are other bands where it's just like, all right, let's all sit down together and, you know, work on this together. And I think that, I mean, I think they're all awesome. I feel like, what, like, I really get the sense that, like, bands like Radiohead or bands that just, like, all sit down together and write songs together. Like, I feel like, I just get the sense, I'm not sure if I'm right or not, but I don't think that, like, Tom York is writing a song and then bringing it to the rest of the band. I feel like they are a type of band that kind of, like, you know, does it together. And then, like, maybe, like, a band like, I don't know, like, you know, I guess Kurt, like, you know, I guess like Kurt Vile or LCD Sound System or Courtney Barnett, I feel like that's a person who, like, brings a song to the band, and then they kind of, like, go from there.
Yeah. Yeah, we were in a hardcore band together, and it was definitely, like, everybody, there's only like one of everything. One guitar, one bass, one vocalist. So it was definitely like, I was the bass player, so I wasn't bringing songs to the band. So.
Right. It's kind of tough to write songs on bass. It's possible, but it's kind of tough, especially if you're in a punk band.
Yeah.
It's going to go like this, and it's going to go like this. It's like, what?
I don't know what the harmony will sound like, though.
Right. God, dude.
But like our guitarist would be the one who would have, he would have like a series of riffs, and then he would bring those in, and then it was, he would build the song based off of like a couple riffs, but he was the primary, if you want to say, songwriter. It's way more collaborative than I expect. And then Dylan would write his own lyrics too.
Right, right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, guitar hardcore band is, it's not, because I would think, I was thinking like hardcore bands and heavy bands in general, they're easier to be more collaborative because they're not necessarily written with like a chord progression in mind. They're pieced together a little bit more. So it's like when you have, you know, multiple instrumentalists in the band, you might have someone, here's a riff, let's, can we do this, something with this, and then, but yeah, one guitarist hardcore band, it was all on him to write.
I feel like a one guitar hardcore band, like, that guy's gotta be a fucking ripper.
He came to hardcore from like metal, so like he knew his stuff really well. Right. So
you gotta rip, dude. Like, you can't be just giving me power chords the whole damn time. I need to hear something.
Yeah.
I mean, but funny enough though, like the song Alone on our record, I wrote that one on bass for, it's literally just one bass line over and over, but technically, I wrote that one on bass first, and then I added like the guitar. Like I had that chord progression for bass melody in my head, and I was like, "All right, I'm gonna work this one out, and then I'll add guitars on this after." And that's essentially, you know, I mean, the whole song is just fucking bass anyway.
Yeah, I tried to start a band with this guy one time, and it was just me and him at the beginning for a long time. We never found a drummer, so like we never did anything.
Nice. That'll definitely get you off the ground.
But like I played bass and I would write these songs on bass and then I would bring them to him, and neither one of us were good enough musicians to actually like be able to explain how to play the songs to each other.
Oh no.
So we were just like, what are you playing? Like we're just looking at each other's hands and trying to figure out what the roots are. Like it's like we're not good enough musicians for this.
That must have been a shit show.
Yeah, we did nothing. We never
What chord should I play here? I don't know. Right?
I just played one string, so I don't know what chord you need to play.
Like, well, what chord am I playing?
So the record came out on Forged Artifacts, who
it sure did
have a pretty good year right now. Especially they put out that Half Stack album earlier this year, and they put out a record last year from a band called A Hymn that I really liked. How'd you wind up working with that label? They kind of seem to be on the upturn, or you know, like they're up and coming label,
right? I mean, well, shout out to Forged Artifacts, they're awesome, and Matt Linden, it's like, he pretty much runs the whole show. You know, he was a huge help in, you know, getting this record like out and whatnot. But it's funny, I guess the way that I came in contact with them was, all right, so about this time last year, I just had like three demos of the album ready to go, like presentable. So I was like reaching out to so many different labels, just seeing if I can like get one label to get on board to want to put this out. And I was sending these demos out to so many labels. And like all of them were like, hell no, dude, fuck off. Not even responding, just being like, no. And I'm like, fuck, all right. And so I keep on. And then like, you know, 2020 comes around and I'm still working on the record. I got some more songs now where I'm closer to finishing the album. Well, I'm just about finished, really. And I'm still pitching this record out to so many labels. Like, talking to all the friends that I know that work in the music industry, getting like, if I showed you my notepad of labels that I have, like I've sent it to so many. I like a little checklist, and like most of them didn't respond, or most of them were just like no. And I sent a demo to Disposable America, and like around this time last year, and then Dustin, who is, I guess, the owner of that label, reached out to me in like February or January, something like that, like months, like 5 months, like so long after I reached out to him. And he was like, hey, like, I love what you got going on, but it's a no, we can't put this record out. Damn it. But he's like, but here are these other labels I think you should reach out to. And I was like, okay, cool. So then I reached out to a couple of them, didn't really hear much, reached back out to Disposable America. He gave me some more labels to reach out to. I reached out to some more. I spent so much time sending emails. You have no idea.
I mean, I know what it's like to send 1,000 emails.
Right. And so Dustin put me in contact with Forge Artifacts. I reached out to Forge Artifacts beginning this year. And at first, like, now, I wasn't really sure because I reached out and it was like, yeah, we like it, but we got some other stuff going on. So, you know, we'll see what we can do. And I was like, all right, well, I'll just keep on looking then. And then as I got closer to like finishing the record, I reached back out. But then COVID happened. And when COVID struck, Matt George was like, hey, man, like, we'd love to put this record out, but our presses are closed. We can't, you know, do anything right now. So I was like, shit, all right. So, you know, I waited maybe like another, like, you know, month or two and reached back out to them. And then that's when we finally started the dialogue. And funny enough, like, Forge Artifacts is based around, is based in Minneapolis. And the first time me and Matt talked, like, on the phone, like, to discuss the record and whatnot, was like a week after, like, what happened with George Floyd. So, like, our whole pretty much discussion was just based around, like, that. And, yeah, like, we talked about the record a little bit, but, like, we were kind of talking about, like, that shit. I mean, because Matt was, like, literally watching his city burn. I mean, meanwhile, like, I was kind of just, like, getting all this weird attention from everyone. The Big Easy started getting all this, like, attention and shit. Like, I swear, no one gave a fuck about the Big Easy until, like, I started stealing, like, a bunch of, like, random interviews out of nowhere, like, in response to the Black Lives Matter movement, which is all great. But so, like, our big discussion was like, around that, and we kind of, like, were on the same page about everything, and we had the same vision about what we wanted for the record. He was willing to pretty much give me everything I wanted for the album, which was, I don't think, too much, but, like, he facilitated pretty much all of that. Everything that I wanted to do, he's the reason why. And we were just on the same page about everything. But long story short, like, I got hooked up with Forge through Disposable America, who put us in contact. And then from there, we kind of just, you know, ran with it.
Yeah, I feel like, I guess, like, punk, DIY, indie music around George Floyd was, like, they just looked around and were like, shit, we're kind of complicit in, like, not having enough diverse, you know, people, voices in our...
Oh, my God. I just looked around and was like, fuck, dude.
Oh, shit, we're just talking to more white people. This is... yeah, it's a strange thing that's happened. It's a great thing that's happened, that's needed to happen forever. But at the same time, it's just like, it's weird what it took to get people to care and make an effort.
Right. I think that's the kind of the weirdest part about it. You know, I would say, and I've been saying this a lot, you know, I would say that any, you know, black person of color, that's at least like a little socially aware or conscious, you know, must feel like extreme, like, complex feelings right now in regards to, like, the attention that they're getting, because, you know, it's almost just like, well, shit, like, I've been doing this for a long ass time and nobody gave a fuck. And now all of a sudden, like, you guys want to do these interviews and now you guys want to feature my band. And now, and it's like, hell yeah. I mean, like, you feel like you deserve it and you feel like, you know, you've been wanting it for a while. But at the same time, it's like, damn, like, is this what it took for it to happen? And then at the same time, you're all here trying to, like, suss people out and be like, is this person just trying to, like, you know, ride this wave or, like, or ride this moment or not? Or are they actually down for it? Are they actually about it? And that's kind of, like, what I feel like a lot of people are having to kind of, like, that, like, internal struggle, I think, like, a lot of people are kind of, you know, asking themselves these days.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely, I've definitely seen labels, like, signing new bands. and then being like, huh, all white dudes again, huh? So it's always like, there's like amazing artists out here, and you're just like, and we got another white one.
Yo, the craziest thing that I saw was, I saw Run for Cover was doing like a live stream, like audio trees and like, I don't know, some like live stream, and they were going to donate all the proceeds to, I think, so what, like whatever black owned organization, you know, in response to, you know, Black Lives Matter movement. All the bands, not a single band had any black people in the band. And I'm looking at the lineup, I'm like, what the fuck is this? I swear to God, I was just like, what the it's like it was wild.
Went out of their way. Like, I feel like that's hard to do almost. To be like, to not get even one band with someone.
Dude, it was wild. Like, and it's crazy because I know that like someone that I knew was signed to Run for Cover, and they passed our demo to them right when I was kind of like, you know, doing this whole thing. And obviously they passed and didn't say much or anything. And then like, so like at that, like, I always know when like, just like, it's almost like, you know, when you're an athlete and someone tells you you can't make it to the big leagues, and then you try harder and then you make it to the big leagues and shit like that. And so like, you know, I would see like on my SoundCloud, like who listened to the record and then like, you know, who didn't hit me back or whatnot. And it's always like, okay, made a mental note. So I feel like I've always kind of like a bone to pick with that label anyway. And then I see them kind of like do this, like this live stream, you know, for like Black Lives Matter, and then don't have any bands that have anyone who's black enables bands. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
They kind of got dragged for it too, if I remember.
I remember Twitter was kind of like, you know, saying some shit about them and whatnot. And look, I think they're a great label. Like, don't get me wrong. Right. I'm not sitting here talking shit about Run for Cover. I think they're a great label and they have some amazing bands on that label. I just thought it was kind of funny, you know?
Yeah, my thinking on it is, okay, if you have a history of not signing bands with black artists in it, then make an effort. Like,
right.
Because once you get in the habit of making that effort and decision to like seek out black artists, it just becomes second nature anyway. Like, it's
right.
Not
right.
After a while, you're just like, it stops registering almost that, mm-hmm. like, well, I found this band and then I found this band. It's just like, it's so easy to just get in the mindset of just try a little bit.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of weird because, I mean, for a while, like, you know, before any of this, I was never someone that kind of, oh man, it's really weird to even kind of say, like, I was never someone that was like really kind of like trying to put, I guess, my blackness in the forefront of my music. That's not what I was trying to do at all. I just wanted to make music and have people just fucking, you know, listen to it. At the end of the day, like, I'm a black artist, so it's always going to be the forefront. Like, you know, I'm the songwriter, singer of this band, and people are going to see me. And so, what this whole, I've learned so much from this, like, in this past year than I've ever learned. I've learned so much in this past year. And, I realized that, like, there is no way getting around that. Like, I feel like it's now, people are not just going to listen to the Big Easy and be like, oh, it's the Big Easy. I feel like people, or I didn't realize that, I guess people viewed the Big Easy and be like, oh, even if they would say it to themselves or not, like, you know, that band with the black lead singer, you know, and like, you don't really say that for any other band, right? I mean, they would just be the band. But I mean, I realize that's kind of the case for it now. And it's not something I'm mad about. It's just something I always tried to, like, in the past downplay, because that's not what I wanted to be known for. I just wanted to be known for making good music and whatnot. And I never wanted like any shortcuts. I didn't want anyone to kind of like, you know, patronize, because, you know, I didn't look like anyone else like that. But then at the same time, you gotta realize that you probably were not getting the same opportunities as anyone else because of you look different than everyone else. So at this point, it's kind of just like, fuck it. Like, I think that, like, you know, all these black artists, and I, all of a sudden, like, in this past like year, I've seen so many black indie rock artists pop up, you know, and are getting like so big, and they're all so great. And I'm just like, you know, it's just kind of crazy to see. Like, it's, I feel like it's almost maybe becoming normalized. because no one wants to be tokenized. Mm. That's the one thing you don't want. Like, you don't want to be like, oh, that one black band in that one, you know, on that label. You know, it shouldn't be that. But yeah, I mean, I don't even know like where to begin. And honestly, that's not even for me to even figure out. That's for everyone else to figure out. Like, that ain't my fucking problem anymore. I got enough of those. But yeah, I mean, it's just crazy to see. And it's also like really awesome and uplifting to see, you know, like I always felt like I can't be the only black dude doing this shit. Yeah. You know, I can't. If I'm doing it, there's got to be other people. But how come I don't see them? Like every right. show, I've never really played a show in which like I was like, you know, amongst like other black artists.
Right.
You know, that like, I would say, like, yeah, pretty much like every show I've ever played. So, you know, that kind of like, you know, that means something in a way. And then when you see like start to happen now, you see all these artists kind of like breaking through. And I don't know if it's in response to the movement or not. I would guess it is. But either way, it's just like it's just nice to see things look a little different these days.
I think a part of the problem was the exposure wasn't there from the people that should have been making an effort to expose the greater audiences to black artists. Like,
right.
It became a focus. Like, before, there weren't these, like, Excel documents listing every black artist, like, regardless of genre, you know,
mm-hmm.
which there are now out there, which is odd. Right. It's like, well, go to the database and look and find one. Like, it's just
what is this?
What is happening? But at the same time, you almost had no way of like searching for that in the first place. It's like
right,
a Reddit post from 6 years ago. You can maybe find something, but like, it is. It's like the people who should have been making a more conscious effort weren't, and this year they'd finally decided to pay attention and. It's worked out so great for a lot of musicians now, but
yeah,
it is interesting. It has to move past tokenism. It has to move past just like fulfilling a quota.
Right. So, exactly.
I want to say I found your video through No Earbuds. I think.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah.
Jamie
Coletta. She is a wizard at what she does. She's awesome. Like
she shared the video and I was like, this video is cool. It's like a fun like party, like prom sort of setup.
Right.
I guess.
Yeah.
And it was just
disco
like,
balls, baby. Disco balls.
I was like, this is great.
Tell,
I
it's
can't
a common
wait.
Theme on the record. a lot of disco balls.
And my listening to it, I was like, shit, this is kind of like we mentioned Beach Slang a little earlier, but this feels like the Beach Slang record that should have come out this year because they put one out this year that is I'm not a fan of. But
I didn't even know they did.
It was like pre-COVID, so like,
it's, oh yeah, I mean that got washed away then. Yeah. But then COVID just took over everything.
I was like, I listened to it. I didn't like that record, and I was like, this is very disappointing. And then your record came along, and I was like, this is way better than what they should have been doing. But I love the record. It's fantastic.
Thank
I recommend
you
so everyone.
Much that I'm humbled. I'm humbled to hear that. That's great.
I recommend everyone get it. I'm gonna get it. I don't have a physical copy yet. I'm gonna get it on one of those Bandcamp Fridays, which I thought
That's
was last
this Friday.
Friday.
That's this Friday.
I thought it was last Friday, and so I was like, oh yeah. And then I went to look and I was like, it's not today. Oh, okay, I'll wait. I'll wait another week.
I'm sorry.
Well, I just didn't look at the calendar. Shit, we talked a long time. Let's talk about we gave you the year 1997.
It's something unpredictable, but in the end is right. I hope you had the time of your life.
These updated charts are interesting.
Right.
Yeah. It's what,
but I want to know, like, why wasn't Lonesome Crowded West the number one,
I guess,
at that time?
So, like, it was, it's right there, it's tagged as indie rock, and this new updated chart allows you to pull in not just, like, the specific genre, but, like, the also influenced by.
But what was the genre we, like, were going by?
I mean, I just put in punk, and it tends to bring up emo, hardcore, all that kind of stuff. Right. Indie rock is just, like, one step away, even though we've said forever that, like, indie rock is one of those things that's, like, it got all of its notes on how to operate punk rock, so, like, it's an extension of punk music. It's just a cleaned-up version, I guess. But
Right. That's interesting. Wow, I guess it doesn't really consider... Cause, I mean, I consider Nothing Feels Good an indie rock album, you know? I always viewed it that from that lens, and then... From there, it was also an emo album, a punk album. So I always kind of, like, put it indie rock first.
Right.
But I guess I might be wrong in that sense, you know? Because I also viewed, like, you know, Lonesome Crowded West as, like, an indie rock album, but also an emo album, and also, like, a lo-fi kind of, like, record as well.
Yeah, it's...
I mean, so much of what's emo in 97 is either, like... Get Up Kids, where it's leaning much more into pop punk, or Mineral, or Promise Ring, where it's leaning a lot into, like, indie rock and almost like a pop rock. So it's I don't think you're too far off thinking of it as an indie album.
Right. I think it's always kind of funny to just, like, hear how other people do, like, loop albums that we're both familiar with and genres. So I'm like, oh no, well, I hear, like, indie rock. So I was like, no, I heard, like, this. And I'm like, well, we listened to the same album.
Well, what you're hearing are their individual influences that inspired this record. So
Right.
It's just you're more attuned to one sound than the other person is. So
Yeah. That's definitely a way of thinking about it. Like, I'm always like, even when it comes to, like, the Big Easy and shit, like, you know, like, since this album came out, I've been, you know, hearing so many different, like, I guess, genres and labels were being thrown into that I never even, like, I'm like, I don't hear that shit at all. But, you know what I mean? But, like, I've been kind of hearing that a lot. Like, I've been seeing, like, a lot of people loop the Big Easy into pop punk, and I never considered the Big Easy a pop punk band ever. And I think it's because, like, I view pop punk, like, when I was hearing pop punk, I was, like, in my teenage years, so I was, like, you know, 2003, 2004, 2005, and pop punk was, I think, different than what it was in the 90s, so... You know, pop punk for me was kind of like, you know, like Sum 41 and Blink 182 and shit like that. And I'm like, I hated those bands. I hated those bands growing up. So when people go like, oh, like the Big Easy's got like some pop punk, I'm always kind of like, wait, what? Ew, stop.
It's so funny because, like, I call everything punk, even if, like, most people don't. And there was, like, this period where I would call stuff like Dillinger 4 pop punk. And it kind of is.
Right.
But at the same time, it's Midwest pop punk, so it's a little different. But
right.
I mean,
right.
Yeah. You can break it down into smaller and smaller subgenres and sounds if you want to, which I feel like I've moved away from that a lot in my life.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I did that so much as, like, a metal kid, high school teenager, and was just like, no, it's atmospheric sludge, post-sludge.
Like, what?
Just kind of metal. I mean, whatever.
It's funny, the things you get hung up on when you're younger, too. Like, right. I definitely got more hung up on genre, like, descriptors when I was young.
I think that's kind of just a thing that, like, you go through as someone who loves music. Like, especially, like, when you're, like, in the indie rock music scene and shit. Like, you know, you kind of just, like, get so hung up on the genres and, like, no, like, you know, I'll make you, like, just have that, like, I know more than you, or I know a lot about genres and shit. And, like, I think at that time, everyone kind of has to go through that phase until they realize it doesn't fucking matter. Like, it doesn't matter at all. But I think that, like, that's kind of something that one needs to go through in, like, their maturing process and as a music lover or being passionate about music. Like, you're always going to, like, you're going to dive deep. You're going to want to learn more about this, that, and the third. And then you're going to use your knowledge and try to, like, say it in any chance that you get. You know, to be like, yeah. Oh, no, this is an art punk album. Or this is avant-garde. It's like, what, dude? It's just a fucking... This is just a... And I think that was kind of, like, a big thing. You know, at least it was a big thing for me when I was, like, in high school. So I feel like kind of everyone kind of goes through that, I suppose. In the scene that, I guess, we're discussing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, some people never grow out of that, too. Like, there's definitely, like, this particular website that we look at, they definitely, there's a lot of people on here that are like, no, this is the wrong tag.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I get on it, too, when it's, like, way off base. But right, at the same time, somebody's just like, it's alternative rock. It's like, that encompasses a lot of different stuff. Yeah. What are you talking about?
Yeah,
true.
Like, power pop, I guess, is, like, my big, like, people use that term wrong most
What's
of the time.
What's power pop?
So, like,
Alright, so, like, to me, like, power pop would be, like, maybe, like, Fountains of Wayne, or, like, you said power pop? Or, like, or maybe, like, even, like, you guys ever seen the Knack? Or, like, the, like, kind of, like, like bands I don't really know how to describe it, but, like, you know what I mean, right?
Yeah,
I tend to split it into kind of two different eras and not much else. Like, to me, primarily I think of it as, like, late 70s pop-oriented rock music that isn't punk, prog, or new wave.
Right,
like,
catchy as hell. Usually, it's gotta be catchy.
It's super catchy and some crunchy guitars, probably some, like, you know, really fun dual lead guitars or something like that.
And it's
it's
sick.
And then, like, the kind of 90s version of that, where, like, Weezer or Teenage Fan Club or Fountains of Wayne would be a great, like, the bands in the 90s that were looking back to those 70s bands and drawing a lot of inspiration from them, that weren't, you know, grunge bands or
I mean, that's what I think power pop is. I was curious to know if I was on the mark with that.
You are. A lot of people, though, use it now to apply it to, like, basically anything with, like, catchy melodies and it's kind of upbeat. So, like, I'm trying to think of who was one that, like...
They're
more recent.
This year, the New Warriors record I saw it called power pop, and I was like, it's a punk record. Like, I mean, there's some rock influence, but it's a punk record. Like, it's a punk band. Historically, they have been a pop punk band. I don't know. I think there's an aversion to calling things punk for a lot of people. I think there has been, because it draws a kind of what you were saying about pop punk. Like, you don't want to group it with. You don't want to group these bands that you like with these bands that you don't. And I think that's where a lot of people get kind of hung up, where it's like, it's not classic punk, and it's not skate punk, and it's not pop punk. And if they don't listen to a lot of punk music, they would probably just be like, I don't know, it's power pop.
Punk kind of got a... So, like, there was, like, that 90s reputation, just, like, you know, skateboarding, Warped Tour, Mountain Dew, you know. That's like your extreme.
Gotta throw in Mountain Dew. Damn.
Tony Hawk Pro Skater soundtrack. And then, like, I guess that in the early 2000s, it turned into, like, the, like, emo just became, like, a term for everything that was.
Like a lifestyle in a way, really.
Yeah. And then, like, so, like, all those bands that would have just been, like, pop punk bands are now called emo. And then, then there was like,
but that's not emo. Like,
April,
you know, like, Sum 41 and, like, I don't know. I just don't feel that, like, you know, Blink 182 or shit like that, or even, like, emo bands. They're just, like, pop punk, like, punk bands, you know? And maybe they may have, like, some kind of a little bit of tinge. And, like, I'm not saying you can't group them in the same, like, I'm not saying that, like, Blink 182 and My Chemical Romance can't play a show together. They can definitely play a show together and you'd be fine. Yeah. But, like, I just, like, never, like, I'm at an emo night and I fucking hear Blink 182 come on. I'm like, this isn't emo.
Yeah.
Like, I want to hear some fucking, like, cursive and fucking, like, you know, this is what I want.
You know, it's funny. I was looking at 1997, so, like, I guess for the show's sake, that's the year we assigned you. And, like, I was looking at the emo records that came out that year. And so the big, big ones are Minerals, Power Failing. Like, is that the first Mineral record or the second one? That is the first. Yes, the first. In Serenading was the second one. So there's that one, a record we're talking about today. Get Up Kids, 4 Minute Mile.
Right.
There's a Dismemberment Plan record, but that's when they start getting weird. Like,
right, but I mean, that Dismemberment Plan record, I'm not sure if it's like before. No, I think it's like their first or second, right?
I don't know. Let's see.
Because I feel like, all right, so like I would have definitely chosen Dismemberment Plan to talk about had it been Emergency and I.
Yeah, and yeah, I that was 99.
And I think that one came out after. That's when they like... We're not like that's to me like it's not really an emo record. I would say it's more like a post-hardcore indie rock first, and then like I guess post kind of punk, post-hardcore, kind of weird. It's got some dancey vibes in there too and shit.
Right.
But like even that to me, I wouldn't even like kind of consider like emo.
It's funny, like people kind of took that band, like people into emo kind of took that record, and were like, that's one of ours. It's like, I mean, it. Kind of. Maybe vocally that's when they get it. They
responsibly hijacked it.
They're just like, that's ours. Yeah, we claim that one.
It's like, this is a good record. This is ours now. Emo was good music.
This is a band that gets a lot of indie cred. We want this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
You can have Jimmy World now. We're done with them.
Yo, like right. that's like such a funny idea for like a skit. Where, like, you know, different representatives of, like, different genres are, like, picking and choosing which ones they get the, and, like, trading albums or trading records. He's like, no, this is an emo record now. You can have this for your, like, post-hardcore genre.
Which it kind of happens. Like, pretty, like, I don't know. Like, it definitely happens where people are like, they're one of ours. Like, you know, we're metal kids can have that band over here. But
we don't want them anymore.
Yeah. We've got what I want. We wanted out of them.
Yeah. That's kind of our, like, Justin's calling everything punk that's not necessarily punk. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of just like, you know, it's close enough, like, I'll claim it. Like, it's...
Yeah. they approach music in, like, a independent spirit, which is very much a punk thing. I mean, though, you know, Sex Pistols were on EMI, and Ramones are on Sire Records, so, like, you know, it was always a major label thing in the first place. It's right. I guess it's the US version of SST Records, Discord Records, like that truly independent spirit that kind of took over. Because then everybody would call out bands for signing to majors. Like Husker Du got yelled at for signing to Warner Brothers. And
right.
Like, shudder to think of all bands signed to a major record label.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, but then in the 90s it just blew up anyway with Green Day being like, a major label band. I mean, they started on Lookout, but like, it's funny. I just remember people calling Sellout for a lot of stuff. When now I'm just like, are the songs good? Because that's really all that matters at this point. Can people I enjoy
up,
it?
I mean, people get caught up in the you know the scene or the this is fucking being pretentious, really. Like, you know, that's I think that's kind of what it is. Like, and I think that like that's another thing that I feel like. You kind of get to a point you grow out of. It's just like, dude, I don't care what label you're signed to. I don't care what genre, you know, people are calling you and shit. Like, as long as the record's good, it's fine. And that's kind of like the way I view it when people like, when I started seeing like, you know, the pop punk kind of like influences or tags for the Big Easy record. I'm at a point where I'm just like, well, do people like it? Yeah. Okay. Don't really give a shit then. You know, call it whatever you want.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times audiences determine what, you know, what it's going to be called anyway. Like, how many times have you heard a band who, like, rejected the term the audience, like, gave them? Like,
so many emo bands.
Yeah, yeah. They hate being called emo bands.
I mean...
We're just like a rock band. Like, that's my favorite like, thing.
Shut up, stop it, and you know you're an emo band. And just stop.
Or, like... Slowcore bands who hate the term slowcore, like the Originators, they're like, I just consider myself a rock band. It's like, you play incredibly slow. You are something more than just a regular rock band at this point.
Yeah, you're doing something very different than what rock radio was doing in the 90s.
Right, right.
Math rock, that's another big one where everyone who played it hated the term. They were just like, it's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Really? I feel like math rock is like, yeah, we're mathy. I feel like they hold that flag pretty high.
It turned into that. But I do know a lot of the originators were not crazy about the name. Like, it was almost a joke. Like, it was like, oh, this is like a math rock band. Like, I need that. A calculator to figure out how to play these rhythms.
You know, like, joking aside, though, like, math rock as a genre name is the sickest name for a genre ever. Like, that is dope. Why wouldn't you want to be called that?
You know exactly what it sounds like. Like, oh, someone says math rock, and you're like, oh, yeah, I got it.
Weird time signatures and lots of tapping.
Right. Love that. Noodly guitar riffs.
Do you remember when everything was called, like, noodly or twinkly in, like, the emo scene?
Yeah.
Everybody was like, stop calling us that.
It's like twinkle punk, like noodle pop.
Yeah, yeah.
What does that mean? It's a sick name, too.
We had a friend who was, like, in a band that was in, like, that sound, and he was always like, it's so reductive. It's like, we're more than just twinkling and tapping. I was like, it's true, you got some great melodies in your stuff, but at the same time, it's what your guitars sound like.
So. Right.
I mean, if you're doing that,
expect that tag.
I like that twinkle tag. That was like, well, like 08, I guess, like 2010 was when those bands were kind of like really.
Yeah. It was like I'd say probably like 08 to 2011 was like the strongest it was. 2010 was like the year, was like 9-10 were like the big years for it. Like your Snowing and Grown Ups and all those bands.
Dude, I've seen Grown Ups in concert. That was wild. Like, they played a show here in Brooklyn at this spot called the Anchored Inn. Like, dude, I posted a video of that show on YouTube, and it's still up on YouTube. And it's the only video I've ever posted in my account. It's still up. But that show was awesome.
I love that. Like, I love that full length they did. More songs.
I actually really love the EP they put out after. I thought that was better than more songs. But I mean,
Handholder or something.
Yeah, the one with Wigwam.
Yeah, it's got like the butterflies on the
front. That album, that EP is fucking awesome. Damn.
Yeah. You know, I feel like we're due for a reunion of those bands. Like, Snowing did do like a reunion in Japan.
Yeah, they did. I thought that was like awesome to do, but it's like they didn't do it here. But I heard that like a show and happening in Philly or something before they set off for that tour. They just like were like surprise guests at that show and just popped up and played, and the place went fucking nuts.
I think they even had to post about it saying, like, we're sorry, it got real dangerous. Or, like, it was just, like, too many people were crammed into that, wherever they were. It was, like, a house or something.
Right.
Yeah. Like, next time we'll make sure to do this plenty in advance and, like, only have the people who can get in. Yeah.
Right. But, I mean, at that moment, it's kind of just like, fuck it, dude. We haven't played in a while. Let's just do it.
It's like when Jawbreaker did that, like, what? They did a show in Brooklyn? Just, like, out of nowhere?
Yeah, I think it was the one. I think it was at Brooklyn Steel, which is a legitimate, like, big ass venue. It's like, I think it's the one of the main venues we have out here.
They like did one before the Riot Fest, like, reunion, and like it was like supposedly insane. That would have been crazy to see them,
right,
in that little room.
Mm-hmm.
We got really far from 97.
Right.
Well, the influences on that sound are very active in 97.
Yeah.
That's true. This is true.
Because they broke up in... When did they break up?
95? I don't know too much about Jawbreaker, 96? To be honest.
Don't remember when they... Oh, yeah, they were already broken up by this point because Promise Ring toured with them in 98. Or toured with Jester Brazil in 98. So, yeah, Jawbreaker was definitely done.
Oh, damn, they didn't last too long then, did they?
Like, they started early, I think.
Oh, okay.
Like, late 80s, and then the last record I want to say is 95. Be 95, so they were really ahead of that sound too, which makes sense. You know, everybody picks it up a couple years later.
Right.
Yeah, because there's 97 is a pretty cool year because there's like two Hot Water Music records.
Mm-hmm.
There, There's Forever and Counting, which is my favorite, and Fuel for the Hate Game, which is another, like, classic.
Right.
We have Lifetime's Jersey's Best Dancers. That's when they, like, got real good.
Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, that's funny. I mean, like, when you gave me the year 97, I was like, okay, and you sent me a link. And I feel like I even said this yesterday. Like, I remember, like, kind of, like, going through and be like, damn, like, all these awesome bands that I love, like, released a record. I just don't know any of these records that they're putting out. Like, what was it? Like, I think, like, Built to Spill put on a record, right? Mm-hmm. Was it Cursive put on a record? Dismemberment Plan put on a record. Less Savvy Fab put on a record. The Hives put on a record. Remember that band, The Hives?
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, but it was literally all the records that I did not know. So, like, I was about to hit you up and be like, dude, I think we need to switch up the years.
We've definitely had that before too. Where we were like,
I know, hey. but I was like, no, fuck it. Like, I want to have fun with it. So I was like, screw it. I'm gonna do 97. You gave me 97, and we're gonna do it.
So, good shit in 97.
Right. Yeah. And like, so yeah. I mean, it looked like 97 was a really big year for that type of stuff. I just feel like for me, like, I don't know. I guess I just, like, neglected that year, 97, because I listened to so many albums before 97 and so many albums after 97. And then, like, right. A lot. What's up?
You're right, though. It's not, like, the ones they're well known for. Like, that. Right. I know you're a big Cursive fan. Like, uh-huh. What record is that? It's, like, a obscure one, right?
Yeah,
like,
it's I've heard of some of the obscure ones. I have not listened to that one at all.
Such Blinding Stars for Starving Eyes. I have.
It's like, what, dude?
I've never even heard that, like, what title is this? Before.
that's the first album.
Yeah, so it's like, wow, yeah.
Two albums before Domestika.
Yeah.
So. Two, oh yeah, and then what was the other one? Like, Blinding, or maybe you just said.
Storms of Early Summer,
yeah, Semantics
of Song.
Yeah.
Dude, these titles are incredible. Like, what were they thinking? And that second one that you just listed, I know that one, and that album is actually fucking awesome. That's actually the album where I got the name for the Big Easy.
Okay, because I saw I saw an interview you did with someone who was like, "So is it named after New Orleans?" It's like
no, no. What interview was that? I mean, like, well, I mean, I've been getting that literally since day one. And what's annoying, well, not really annoying, like, you know, I did it to myself, is that like I heard, like, one of the songs on that record, that Cursive record, and one of the lyrics is really cool, and he mentions the Big Easy. And I was like, oh, that's sick. Like, those three words together, that's a sick-ass fucking name.
Yeah.
So I named the Big Easy that, and then I didn't know that was the nickname for New Orleans. So, like, I didn't, like, every time I would tell someone my band name, still to this day, I'd be like, yeah, like, I'm in a band called the Big Easy. They go, oh, like, are you from New Orleans? At the time, I didn't know why everyone kept on asking me that. I was like, why do people keep asking me that shit? I found out it was actually the nickname for New Orleans. And I was like, fuck, my band name just got a lot less cool. It's like, fuck. Like, it'd be like naming, like, my band the Big Apple. Like that. I was like, fuck, dude, that's not stupid. But, I mean, like, whatever. I mean, I'm
here's my new band, City That Never Sleeps.
Yeah. Okay. God, clown.
I mean, it's not as what is it? It's not as a prevalent nickname as, like, the Windy City or something like that.
Right. You know, the Rotten Apple.
Yeah. Have you heard anything from any of? I know there's, like, cover bands that use the name the Big Easy.
Right.
Have you heard anything from any of those bands saying, like, hey, that's our name?
No, I haven't. I mean, I just don't think we're even at a point where people are paying attention to that shit yet. I mean, hopefully I never get that call, but, I mean, I definitely have, like, saw on Spotify, there's, like, this band called Big Easy Band, and then, like, there's, like a bunch of just, like, I guess, like, New Orleans music that, you know, use that, and, like, cover bands and shit, but no, none of that to me just yet. I hope they don't. At this point, like, I look at what they got going on, I look at what we got going on, I'm like, you know what? We're taking this.
You're never gonna cross paths.
Yeah, like, it's like, you know what? Like, we're good. Or maybe we should play a show in the Big Easy and get all those the Big Easy bands on the bill and just have a Big Easy night.
It's just a bunch of like jazz bands and you.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it really is a big point for us now to, you know, go down to New Orleans and play a show down there because, I mean, it's only right.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are some other, like, I see, like, I'm looking at Last.fm because that's usually, like, a good place to see.
If wow, that website still exists?
Oh, yeah. it's still up there. Your album has the most listens under any other album with under the Big Easy name.
Oh,
so.
Hell yeah. Wow, damn. We have the crown then. I'm taking.
You win. You're the most prominent.
Yeah, oh, it's awesome.
No one's going to confuse your brand with, you know, Dixieland's
right
swing rival or whatever.
Oh, I love that for me.
You'll change it in a few years. It'll be like BGEY as you're like your new.
I am ready for that day. I have a large list of band names in the notes of my phone that I can just flip to whenever I need to. Oh my god.
97. There's one record on here that I really wanted to call out before we even go further is The Weaker Than's Fallow. Mm-hmm. It's the first Weaker Than's record. They are one of my all-time favorite bands. We've talked about them a lot on the show. We're still waiting for somebody to pick one of their records one day. But
right. Sorry, I wasn't the one.
Yeah, Weaker Than's Fallow is probably the biggest record on this list for me, personally. You're probably around the same age as us. I'm 34, Dylan's 30.
I'm 30.
Do you remember what you were listening to in 97? Because I don't really. This is like right before I kind of like really became a music kid. Like I was listening to the radio, but.
Right. I mean, to be honest, I have no clue.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, well, I mean, let me take that back. It's not that I don't have any clue. I just wasn't. Like, at 7 years old, I wasn't listening to this shit. I was only listening to kind of, like, you know, what was playing.
Yeah.
And I think around that time, I could tell you that, like, the first musics I, you know, responded to, which was definitely around that age, was Michael Jackson, which isn't obviously too kosher right now, but also Elton John. So, like, at that time, like, I remember, like, I just recently did this little article in which I had to, like, list, like, five songs that kind of, like, in each different phase of my life, like, childhood, teenage years, college years, now and future and stuff like that. And, like, I have this really fond memory of just, like, being in love with the song Benny and the Jets. Like, that song is so good. And so, like... Me and my cousin at the time would just, like, grab, like, the Elton John greatest hits that we had laying around my house. And every time we'd hang out, we'd just, like, go throw that shit out and just fucking sing that song and run around the whole house. But I think, like, if I was going to say I was listening to anything, it probably was, like, just that.
Yeah.
Like, just Michael Jackson, whenever that was on. And, or like, well, that would get the most response out of me, rather. And then Elton John. That's pretty much it.
Yeah, we listened to the radio a lot. We heard a lot of just like whatever records our parents listened to, my dad listened to. So probably a lot of Kiss, Guns N' Roses.
Nice.
I do want to say
early
1997, was the year. Was this the year that we got our CD player
for Christmas?
For Christmas?
I want to say yes.
Because
in 98, the Eve 6 record came out that I had, and it was one of the first, like, probably the first 10 CDs I had. So, yeah, I probably got a CD player in 97.
Then we definitely got it in 97, the Christmas of 97, because in November of 97, Some Kind of Zombie by Audio Adrenaline came out. That was my first favorite.
Had to make sure you cop that.
That was what I was listening to. In 1997, at least the very end of it.
Yeah, I do remember there's a Green Day record this year, Nimrod.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember being, I probably had some cassettes. That's probably what I had before any CDs. And I do remember liking the band Smashing Pumpkins a lot, but I didn't have any of their albums on cassette. I got like the Batman and Robin soundtrack on cassette.
Wow.
Because they have two songs on it.
Wow.
But I do remember watching the music video for Hitchin' a Ride, which is was the lead single off that Green Day record, with my cousin. I was like, I remember it debuting that week, and then I didn't see the debut, but I saw it the next day because they would just run the videos nonstop as soon as when they got it.
I feel like, you know, for me, even growing up, I think a significant record that came out in 97, you can probably correct me if I'm wrong on this, and we're kind of straying a little bit, but it was probably what I was hearing a lot was Jay-Z's second record, Hard Knock Life, in my lifetime, I think. I think that came out in 97, and I know that was where I'm from and where I grew up, that was big. That was what I was hearing on the radio, Hot 97. Because that's essentially the music I was hearing besides the mainstream shit was a lot of hip hop and a lot of rap. And I know that was probably one of the biggest hip hop albums to come out that year. And you know the song Hard Knock Life was on the radio all the fucking time. And I remember hating that song as a kid, hating that tune and that melody. Obviously, me growing up, looking back at that song's a fucking banger. That song is fire. And also, the Annie song is incredible, too. But it really is. And I think that was kind of if we're talking about 97, I think that's probably the most significant record I can come up with, where I'm from and what we were listening to was probably that one.
I think that was actually 98.
Yeah, I pulled it up. Right, there was In My Lifetime came out in 97. Okay. That was the other Jay-Z.
Okay, so, all right, got it. Because I feel because I know Jay-Z's first record came out in 96, and I always felt like he kind of just followed up every year with a new record and shit.
Yeah.
So I just put in my mind that it might have been 97, but I mean, hell, I've been wrong before.
I mean, things run together, too. From that young, you're not going to be 100% sure. Came out. Exactly. It's like, no, it came out 4 years earlier. What are you talking about? Well, I was five. So what?
Well, thank you for fact checking me. Now I sound like an asshole.
Now nobody's going to yell at it.
They don't even know.
I'm telling you, man, 97 is a hard year for me.
Yeah.
It was a very difficult time in my life.
So we can get into the record we were talking about today. So we gave you 97 and you picked Nothing Feels Good by The Promise Ring. Your head pinned up in circle going like a widow's second emotion of second nature. Like to lead off with this, what made you pick this record specifically?
I mean, I guess aside from being one of the records that I know the most on that list, I think it's really actually that record has been significant for me, and I guess kind of my circle of friends at the time when we were in high school for a long time now, and I graduated high school over 10 years ago. I've known about that record for so long, and that record is just been very significant in, you know, just the whole music journey. You know, I was in a band in high school, my first band, and like my best buddy and like the lead like songwriter in that band, like that's like one of his favorite records of all time. So just naturally being friends with him and hearing it all the time and kind of like knowing about this band, listening to this band. So like our band like was pretty much a ripoff of that shit. So I mean it definitely was significant to me because of like how that record like even like indirectly kind of like influenced me.
Well, cool. I'll run through some stats on this record for those unfamiliar. So a perfectly named album, Nothing Feels Good for 2020. They definitely were from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Wisconsin turned out to be important this week.
Yeah. Wow.
They existed from 95 to 2002. This was released on October 14th, 1997. So
it's my anniversary.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it is. it was released on Jade Tree Records, and this is their second album and by far their most popular. Mm-hmm. The personnel on this record is Davey Von Bohlen on guitar and vocals, Jason Uecow on guitar, maybe, Scott Bichetta on bass, and Dan Didier on drums, and the record was produced by Jay Robbins. So those are some of the big notes.
I did not know Jay Robbins produced that one.
He has like produced so many iconic records.
Right.
Like, on top of being on multiple iconic records as the main musician, you know.
Right.
Yeah, I was shocked to see this was a Jay Robbins record, too. I guess it's kind of early, right? When did he start?
Would be the time where he really started to produce a lot of records.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see if I can figure out what else he produced in this time around this time period, because I know he did some stuff that was close, like in the same lane. He did Do You Know Who You Are by Texas Is the Reason in 96.
I love that record. If we did 96, I would have chose that record.
That record is so amazing.
It's so good.
Yeah. They're like that. A great band.
Yeah.
So yeah, it slapped.
And he did Frame and Canvas by Braid in 98.
So there you go.
Those are like... He did three, some pretty high grade emo of the late 90s.
I mean, he's probably the reason why. He's probably a big reason why those albums are really that's so good.
They're super slick. Because, like, I sampled a little bit of the record that came before this Promise Ring record. And it's solid, but yeah, the production on this one takes it to another level.
Right.
And then, like, the record after is even, like, more produced, and I don't remember who the producer on that record was, but, like, mm-hmm. this is, like, the nice middle ground of, like, not underproduced, not overproduced, like...
Right.
Just right. And it's just funny, yeah, he's...
It has that... Yeah, it has that Jay Robbins, like, it's that sound. He's got a sound, and it's not really obvious. It's not like Steve Albini or someone like that.
Right.
Like, it'll sneak by you, but when you... know it's him, you go, all right, like mm-hmm. all the pieces are there, like everything is really up front, everything is really well balanced, really strong rhythm section on mm-hmm. everything he records, the rhythm section is just pristine.
Well, have you heard that other band he was in, that band Burning Airlines?
Right.
Yeah.
I think he did like that record too. And but did he or not?
Probably. Like, I would assume he produced his own stuff, yeah.
I don't want to talk out my ass and get fact-checked.
I mean, I just did too, so. I assume everything he's on, he produced himself.
Right. But, I mean, that record, like that first one they did is so good, but it also sounds so good. Like, the drums in there, like, they slap.
Says it was produced by the band... Peter Gray, Mansign, Chad Clark, and Don Zientara. It's a DC record, so of course Don Zientara is involved in some way.
Nice.
Probably his studio. So yeah, he had a hand in the production. So
right.
It's a safe.
But yeah, I did not know he did that Promising record. That is cool.
No, like, and he, I guess he just like kind of helped shape the overall sound of emo in the late 90s, like, which definitely. Is because John Mux themselves, I guess early material you could put in that, you know, emo core sound, sort of.
Carrying a lot of what Embrace and Dag Nasty did mm-hmm. In the 80s. I feel like I feel like Jawbox was a direct extension of that.
Yeah. It's like the next step in that, yeah. It's really good.
Yeah, so, I gotta bring up on my end too. Let me yeah, here it is. Let me get this track listing up. Got it.
So like I've heard this record before you picked it for the show. So like I was familiar that this is a classic record. I've heard it myself. And then like I listened to it again, I was like, I forgot how good this record really
is. Exactly. That's what happened to me. Dude, I haven't listened to records so long and I chose it. And they're like, all right, like let me give this record a couple of spins and like, you know, get ready. And I'm like, damn, dude, like every song is hitting me. Like, what? That album is like, yeah, like it was a good kind of like refresher reminder, like how like good this album is.
Like those first four songs? Is This Thing On, Perfect Lines, Red and Blue Jeans, and Why Did We Ever Meet? Mm-hmm. Outstanding.
Like what, dude? Like when the bass on Is This Thing On, like in that last chorus when it drops to like the lower octave, I'm just like, yes. It's like, yes.
Yeah, because he's doing this thing too. He's not like full on strumming at some parts. He's just kind of like holding the chord, so like you hear it moving up and down the neck. But he's not like full strumming it, and it's just like the bass is doing all the work on that.
Right. Yeah, they do that. I mean, I think the bass on this record is so good. Like, he's really doing his thing, like moving around and kind of just like, I don't know, like the bass is just awesome on this album.
You know what's really funny is, though? This dude left the band, like, after this record came out. So, like, in the liner notes, it credits him as, like, the bass player and, like, a writer on the record, but then and in it does that thing where it's like the band is, and then like instead of his name it says Tim Burton because it's the guy's name who replaced him in the band. And it's just like apparently like the drummer and the bass player did not get along, and they had to fall out. They had a falling out basically, and was just like, all right, we're done with him. We're gonna get a new bass player for our
tour. Wow, I know that. I mean, like, if you're asking me, I think the bass playing is better than the drum playing on that record. If it came down to that, I'd be like, you know.
You know, I certainly noticed it more. Like, it's definitely what stands out more than the drumming. I think the drummer and the lead singer had a really close relationship because they did projects together later, too.
Got it.
So, you know, it's like choosing your friends. So.
Right. I understand that.
I think the drumming on this record is interesting. In a kind of understated way, it's to me, it was very much not what I would have expected from a drummer playing in an emo, indie rock,
right,
sort of pop punk, sort of punk
mm-hmm.
band at this time period. He's got a it's just a very continuous sound. It's almost mm-hmm. like a dance beat,
right?
But then there are little subtle things, like he's got some little like triplet fills and. It's interesting if you pay attention to it, but it, mm-hmm. it definitely doesn't grab you immediately.
Right. I always find the bass just, like, grabs me immediately.
Mm.
Like the bass lines on this record are so... They're such their own thing.
I was reading, too, that he, like, specifically made a point to not just play the root on this record. Like, he went out of his way to try and come up with, like, a unique pattern or, you know, like, melody with the bass. Which,
I'm not surprised. It really shows.
Yeah, because like, yeah, a lot of the songs, like the guitar isn't even going throughout the entire.
So what's really cool about all right? So I have this thing in music where I absolutely love when like a guitar part or like anything, like a melody stays the same as the chord progression continues, and like that's like I fucking love that shit. And they do it twice on this album. It's on like Pink Chimneys and Make Me a Chevy, where the guitars are playing the same thing the whole song. And the bass line is giving you the chord progression and like moving the song along. And I love that so much. So like, I was going to say the bass, like the guitars in this record is like, you know, it's cool. It's not bad, but like, they're not really doing anything too crazy, I don't think. I'm never like getting caught off guard by the guitar or like anything like that, but like I'm constantly getting caught off guard by the bass lines, like this part and like the verse here, and then like all that Philly, like it's crazy. or like even like the like a broken tenor, like that song is pretty much like listen to the bass. He's going off on that.
Yeah, that one has like a swing to it. Like that right. broken tenor, it's got like this bounce to it that like some of the other songs don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a bounce to like Forget Me, the last track. It's like a bouncy tune, but
mm-hmm.
Pink Chimneys, it's so funny. Like the record starts with like four killer tracks. Make Me a Chevy is great, and it's also a very repetitive song lyrically. I mean, so is the opener. Right. But and then it does like weird stuff like How Nothing Feels is not really a full song, it's just more like an interlude-y thing. And Raspberry Bush is like a slower song. There's an acoustic song in there too.
Mm-hmm.
But then like Pink Chimneys, B is for Bethlehem, and Forget Me. It's like you knocked it out of the park with the last three songs on the record too. Like
I think B for Bethlehem is the best song on the album.
It's like a standout song.
That song is stupidly good.
Which you almost never see at the end of a record. It's like the second to last track.
That's true.
People are like, let's front load the record, all the great stuff. But they like sandwiched this album with like top, you know, two really great ends to it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. For me, I always kind of looked at this, like, I've always looked at this record as obviously, like, a very, you know, important indie, you know, emo record. But the part that really kind of made it cool for me, and this is also part of the reason why I love Modest Mouse so much, too, is that, like, a lot of the times in this genre, the bass really isn't doing much of anything, or the rhythm section is kind of just, like, you know, doing their thing, and it's really about, like, the guitar playing and the lyrics and the delivery of the vocals and whatnot. But I feel like for this record, not to say that stuff isn't prominent on this album, but I feel like what made this one different is like the bass playing. And I feel that way about Modest Mouse too, more so even the drummer of Modest Mouse. But the way like, you know, you already have a good song and then they give you something extra to kind of like listen to or be into outside of like the main stuff. Why we like, emo or indie rock in a way. Like, we're so obsessed with, you know, the lyrics, how they're delivered, you know, and, you know, guitars and the screaming and yelling and whatnot. But then on top of that, like, you have this guy, this rhythm section, like, giving you, like, killer bass lines and making you kind of bop a little bit. Like, yeah, I'm like, this is sick. I feel like this record was really, really one of those that did that exceptionally well.
You know, it's funny, I was thinking of, like, the vocals, and they're a little buried in places. Mm-hmm. Like, is this thing on? Is like, it starts, and he's kind of, like, hidden a little bit. It takes a little bit to realize how much he's repeating himself in that song.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I feel like in Perfect Lines is when he really, like, kind of steps out and, like, becomes more an intricate, you know, a very important part of the song, especially like the Bell South, Southern Bell references in that song.
Sure.
So like he has an interesting voice. It's like a smooth voice. He's not like shouting, but he's also not like a standout singer in the sense that like oh, wow, listen to what he's doing with his voice. You know, it's just like he fits what he's doing, and it's more what he's saying than how he's singing it. But
he definitely has a standout vibe for sure.
I think what makes him an interesting vocalist is his phrasing, like the way he, it's more his rhythm in his voice than it is anything he's doing melodically, because most of the melodies are pretty simple. And I mean, there's definitely some really catchy ones.
You know, yeah.
Certain verses, certain choruses are really, really memorable, but he's not having to like push himself to do it. He's just kind of like reciting it. All of his lines are like that. He's just kind of like almost just talking.
yeah, in a way, kind of. I understand. I agree with that 100%.
Like the most note, like to me, like the best chorus or whatever you want to call it on the record is "Why Do We Ever Meet?" And it's just like ba ba ba's. You know, it's not like
ba ba ba.
Yeah. No word.
That happens a lot in this album. I feel like
two of those. There's another like really big one. Is it during King of Champions?
I feel like it's in Perfect Lines, maybe, right? Where he does that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I might be forgetting it already. But he does that, like, you know, ba-da-ba-ba. and I love that type of shit, too. Yeah. I always love when, like, the Beatles just go, ah! And it's like, yeah, like, fuck the lyrics, let's just sing now.
What's the word in the Earth, Wind, and Fire song, September, where it's just like, it's just not even a word. He's just like scatting. It's like right there in the chorus.
Like, that's what I want. Yeah. Like, I don't even care what you're talking about. Just sing it to me, dude. Like, I do not even care.
It took me forever to even realize that song was called September.
Oh, just wow. Body eye. Yeah.
No. Yeah. Body eye. Yeah, that part is awesome. Did you just look up that lyric and it just said body out?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Like, it doesn't have to mean anything. It just sounds so good.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what he means. you know what he means.
I was looking up like some like the background stuff on the band, and like I didn't realize that lead singer was in Cap'n Jazz.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like he was in Cap'n Jazz while the Promise Ring started. It was like a side project, and then Cap'n Jazz broke up and on tour, I think. And so then he's like, okay, well, Promise Ring's my band now, like my full time.
Yeah, focus. He was in Cap'n Jazz. Like, this band is kind of legendary.
Yeah,
kind
of
a big deal. It's kind of a big deal.
It's like the Kinsellas get all the attention from Cap'n Jazz. Captain Jazz.
Oh boy. Oh, you gotta edit that part out.
Captain Bebop.
You can't let the 90s emo kids hear you call that.
No, you idiot. It's not Captain Jazz. Yeah, the Kinsellas kind of get all the attention when it comes to Captain Jazz. And it's like, well, this dude right here, the Promise Ring guy, was in the band too, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. I mean, the Promise Ring didn't sound like Captain Jazz, though.
No.
That's true.
American Football, even though they played like a much slower style than Cap'n Jazz, it's still like that sound. That sound is there. It's very much.
It's that guitar work.
Yeah.
Traced all of the letters.
yeah, they apparently the record was like compared to Knapsack and Superchunk from around this time. And I actually really hear it because Superchunk put out Indoor Living in 97, and that's one of their like more mellow records. And so like it's kind of in that same speed. So it does get that indie rock label just because of its similarities to what indie rock was doing in the mid-90s.
Right. I feel like the quintessential indie rock band at that time was probably like Pavement, though.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, I mean, like, even then, I still think those bands could probably even play the same show. You know, it wouldn't be weird at all.
Not at all. They toured with Jimmy Eat World on support of this record.
Really?
Yeah. Damn, and apparently, the vocalist even has guest vocals on Bleed American on one song.
Yeah. I think he sings in, it goes like, what's the one? Fuck me. I can
pull it up. I know exactly which one it is.
I'm gonna have to do that. Oh, man.
Praise chorus.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. You got me. You beat me. But yeah, it's in that song.
And so,
it's like, cool as hell.
They toured with Jimmy Eat World, and they toured with Jets to Brazil in 98. Which makes sense. They're on Jade Tree too, so that mm-hmm. that makes sense. But they toured with Hum in 98 too, and their van flipped, and whoa, like the lead singer flew through the front windshield. Like the bass player they had got hurt pretty bad. The guitarist hurt. Like is there another guitarist on the record? Right. Yeah. Jason, the other guitarist, he like broke his collarbone. He was in the hospital for like weeks, and then like, when he came back on tour, like, he had a lot of trouble, like, wearing his guitar, you know, while playing because of his collarbone. So, like, they eventually let him go from the band. I don't know if it was just because it was just too much for him and he was still trying to recover, but...
That sucks.
Yeah, it's like, they're at their peak, you know, this record came out. It's like, it did well. They said it sold five figures.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do a tour flip, or a van flip. It's like, ugh. That's
a tragic story.
And like, yeah,
tragic.
I mean, they wound up going back on tour later in the year, and you know, it worked out for them. But it's like, it makes you wonder what momentum they lost by injury,
right?
And well, then like,
and how hesitant you would be to push yourself, you know, to tour constantly, and
yeah.
I mean, well, your health's got to come first. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah,
health has got to come first.
And then later, the lead singer had a tumor on his brain
that
he had removed. I want to say around 2002 or something like that, close to when the band broke up. Mm-hmm. So like, this band has had a lot of like issues as far as health. Yeah, you know,
the devil was trying them. The universe did not want them to make it.
And it became an iconic record, regardless.
Yeah.
Yeah, this record, it is one of those records. It's one of those, when you think of a 90s emo record, it's one of the first album covers that pops into your head.
Right, right.
And it was a record that I had listened to in the past, but for some reason The Promise Ring, I don't know, I guess whenever I was getting really into emo, I gave them a chance, and it just didn't really click with me probably based on what I wanted from emo at that time, mm-hmm. which was probably more like Cap'n Jazz.
Right.
I definitely had a really strong Cap'n Jazz period in college, and Promise Ring was just a band that I was just like, yeah, they're an important band, but they're not for me. So listening to this record now, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, it makes sense to get into the Promise Ring at 30, right? Just like, whoops. That was
this record does slap.
I pulled up the video, too, because they, like, shot a music video for Why Did We Ever Meet?
No way.
And it's got a lot of, like, the staples of, like, a late 90s emo pop punk video. So, like, there's like, thick black glasses. Mm. The Raglan t-shirts with like the somebody's wearing a gas station jacket.
So I was like, is there any flannel?
No flannel. This is like just a little past that, but they are driving like a classic car, and right. there's like a BMX bike and roller skates, and then like random people in just like costumes, and like it's like a 90s video.
I'm gonna have to check this video out.
But the dude who directed it is Darren Doan. And I don't know if you know who he is. He, like, shot a ton of music videos. He did, like, AFI videos, Blink-182, MXPX. Mm-hmm. But he also directed that Kirk Cameron Saving Christmas movie.
Really?
Yeah. He's just like, what?
It all comes back full circle.
How did that happen?
That is wild. It's just kind of crazy to think about, like, how we think of, like, all these, like, I guess, big names now, but at the time they were all just probably just like a bunch of no name people, or just like, oh, maybe the circle was small and they're kind of doing their own thing. And like to hear that, like, they're kind of like they all were working with people that like doing all this exciting shit, like now, or like, you know, we think they're so awesome because of what they've done, and like they've like been blown up to, like, this different like level in which they were at the time when they were doing this shit together. I always think about that, and it's always kind of fucking crazy to think of like how small that scene probably is, and how many people actually knew each other, you know, or saw each other all the time, or played shows together. Like, have you guys ever like looked at bills from like the 90s and been like, oh my fucking god, I would have given anything to go to that show?
Yeah.
And that show probably would have been like 500 cap, barely.
Yeah. Like, you see those like those stacked shows where it's like, why are there 10 bands on this bill? Like, this is so, but like, and every band is like a legend now.
Right. Like,
how did that happen? You just all knew each other. Oh, he unplugged his headphones and
awesome.
Sorry about that.
We lost you.
Yeah, I'm back. But yeah, I mean, like, it is kind of crazy to think about like all those bills that like are so insanely stacked today, or that would be. So like some of those bills would like be Madison Square Garden.
They would be like reunion, like festival shows, like a lineup you would see at Riot Fest.
Saw this one bill that was like Pavement and like Beck and like, you know, like Sonic Youth or some shit like that, and like that would be a stage.
Yeah,
like today.
Yeah.
Just like Beck alone, really. But like,
right. I was going to say, Beck doesn't even have openers anymore, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Or like one.
Right. Yeah, it's wild. It's crazy to kind of think about, you know. It's just wild.
Well, going for about an hour now, and we did like 40 minutes yesterday. Some of us will get trimmed down, of course. So probably a good wrapping up period, unless anybody has any like final thoughts on the record.
I think we saw all we need to say about it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, cool then. Tell people how they can get the record, you know, where to follow you online, good stuff.
Okay, well, you know, I'm Stefan. I'm in a band called The Big Easy. So I want to thank you guys for having me. Our record came out, I guess, damn, it doesn't even feel like that. I mean, it's already 2 weeks old, I feel. But it came out October 23rd via Forge Artifacts. You can grab that on our Bandcamp. There's vinyl, cassettes. You can find us on Spotify. But yeah, the album's called A Long Year. Check it out. Add it to your playlist. Share it, whatever. But yeah, you can get it on our Bandcamp, which is thebigeasy.bandcamp.com.
Nice. I'll include links to that as well. And then finally, too, we've asked everyone this in the last couple months. Do you have any like specific charities you would like to call out, or like nonprofits that you would like to direct people's attention to?
Oh man, I wish you would have
asked. Oh yeah. The reason why we ask is too, because like it's like there's always something, like right. Something is always happening. So like there's something we could always be giving to as far as like needing help, you know?
Yeah.
And I so mean, like
honestly, I think that at this point, like anything. I feel that, like, anything that's just gonna, you know, help the vibe and, or, like, you know, support the resistance, support the movement, I think, right now. I think that probably a good one will be to look into would be the bail fund. You know, like, we can expect a lot of protests. Like, even just yesterday, you know, I'm in New York City, and, like, just yesterday I was going through Twitter and going through, like, you know, that stupid social media hole that we all go through. And, like, kids were just getting beat on by the cops and getting arrested by the cops. And the videos are out there to see. And, you know, these kids are going to need help, you know, getting out of prison for, like, you know, protesting the bullshit that we're seeing every day. So I think that's something that anyone is looking to donate to. Something I would say the bail fund would be a great thing to look into, because Lord knows we're going to need it moving forward, especially kind of like after this election, which is not even like kind of finished yet, and whatever the results are going to be, it's just going to be crazy. And the bail fund's offering relief to the ones that, you know, deserve it and need it.
Yeah. That's usually where I tend to put my dollars to, is bail funds. Like, I feel like it's the most immediately impactful.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Sometimes, like, you need to see where your money's going, and you see the effect of, like, your contributions. Bail fund, you will see it.
Yeah. For sure. Well, cool. Well, we thanks a lot for doing the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That's so much fun.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. It's funny we broke it into 2 days. We don't think we've done that with anybody.
There's just so much to unpack.
I'll make sure to include links to all that good stuff in the show notes. And before you go, I want to make sure I pronounce your last name right, because Dylan and I are going to record an intro when you go.
Oh,
so.
Boy. Okay. Well, I mean, good luck with this. Technically, like, my name is pronounced Stephen Beltamier. It's very French. I've been listening to people butcher my name literally since day one.
Beltamier?
Beltamier.
Mier.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to have to make sure.
You got to pretend like you're puking.
Beltamier. Awesome.
Oh, yeah, that sounded great.